All right, we're actually on the sidewalk. That's helpful.
True, it is helpful because the other one is in the street.
Yeah, I thought we were going to have to dodge cars. So can you describe what you're looking at?
So this is a Tlingit whale design. It was designed by artist Nathan Jackson, and it was commissioned by the city in 1976. He actually carved it in wood, and then it was cast in iron. I think it weighs about 350 pounds.
And this is no mural. This is no sculpture. This is a what?
This is a manhole cover. Actually, the city now calls them personnel hatch covers.
How politically correct. Well, you're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and I'm standing on the street corner just down the street from our office with my office mate, Paula Whistle. And you also looked into the history of these,
Let's call them manhole covers.
Okay, thank you. These manhole covers, they're kind of all over the city, and you might look down and notice that one is Tlingit art, or you might look down and notice that one is a landscape or a map of downtown Seattle.
Yeah, in fact, my favorite is the map of downtown Seattle. It has landmarks from the city, including the Kingdom.
You looked into this issue of how Seattle decided to make art out of its manhole covers for our series, I Wonder Why, and can you just spiel the story for us?
These were actually part of a whole effort on the part of the city. The late Paul Schell, who was mayor of Seattle in the 90s, but back in the 70s, he was part of this whole team of kind of creative young guys coming out of the protest movement of the 60s who really wanted to make a difference in the urban landscape. And so they would like go and have a beer or 10 and come up with these ideas. And a lot of what they came up with, in addition to these manhole covers designed by artists, are things that we take for granted now, like sidewalk cafes. That wasn't done in the city, and they came up with that idea. 1% for art, where building projects now have to devote a certain percentage to art. And then smaller things like the manhole covers, and also that people could donate things like park benches. So there was just a lot of creative energy, and this was part of that.
And this is really part of the whole awakening of public art in Seattle.
One thing I really like about it, the city has no map of these. You can't go online and find, you know, go to the corner of 2nd and Cedar and see this, because what happened is after the artist did the design and it was cast by the foundry, it went to the utilities, and then they move them around as they need them. They're kind of surprises. You come upon them.
It's just an example of one of these things, how you might walk past something every single day, literally under your feet in this case, and not stop to think about it. But when you look into it, a lot of them have really intriguing origin stories. And these stories can reveal a lot about the place we live and the kind of people that we live among. So we are going to be talking origin stories today on Sound Effect, everything from comic book superheroes to the UFO phenomenon. That's just ahead on KPLU and KPLU.org, so stick around. So to get us started, we are going to begin by hearing an actual origin story. And to help us do that, I am joined now by senior producer Arwen Nix. Hey, Arwen.
Hello, Gabriel. Okay, so for this next story, we're going to hear the very end of a very old story, a creation myth from the Wampanoag tribe. And they live over on the East Coast. And for those who think that they are not familiar, if you have ever heard the story of the first Thanksgiving, the native tribe in that story, those are the Wampanoag people.
Oh, wow. Okay, so a creation myth. Does that mean this is going to tell the story of how the universe came to be?
Yeah, how the universe came to be, how time came to be, which is the beating of a drum that was beating in the darkness, where the stars came from, and how the sun married the stars, and basically anything that exists, where it came to be. It's a creation myth. Everything that was created is created within this story.
Sounds ambitious.
It is ambitious, and it is very long, so we are only going to hear the very end of it, and we're going to hear it from local artist and educator Roger Fernandez.
Yeah, and people might remember Roger. He was on our show earlier. He was on our episode about myths and legends, and Roger is a member of the Lower Elwha Band of the Sklallam Indians on the Olympic Peninsula, and the guy is a master of telling native stories.
He is, and in his education, he uses stories to teach about the environment. That's what he's currently working on now. He also goes to recovery houses and people who are dealing with addiction. He uses stories to help them through their process of recovery. He is great at telling all kinds of stories, and I feel like we were very lucky to have him back in earlier this week to hear the last few minutes of this Wampanoag origin story. And at this point in the story that we're about to hear, First Man is just about to come to be. And he is just about to learn his very first lesson.
Mao Shop and Metadao were living on the shell of the Great Turtle. They knew they couldn't live on the shell of a Great Turtle forever, so they were able to create the earth. They created the world, the hills and valleys and mountains the Wampanoag people live upon. And then they began to make things to put upon this earth. Mao Shop, who was born first, was making good things. He was making things like birch trees and maple trees and deer and turkey and corn and squash and beans, all the good things the people would need. Metadao, who was born second, was angry. And so he was making things that weren't so good. He was making things like sharks in the water. He was making things like mosquitoes and stinging black flies. So they were making things to put upon the world. They made many, many things, but they knew they needed one last being for the world, and so they made First Man. They went to the cliffs. By the ocean, they gathered different colors of clay, red clay, yellow clay, black clay, white clay. They made a body of First Man with arms and legs. They went into the woods, and using their knives together, out of a tree they carved a head, and they put the head on the body of First Man. They made First Man, the first being, the first human being. Now, First Man did not have fur covering his body to keep him warm. First Man did not have sharp claws and teeth to hunt other animals with. First Man did not have wings and feathers to fly in the sky like a bird. They knew that First Man needed something special to live in the world. And so into First Man's head, they put a brain, a powerful brain. And then they told First Man to travel the world and look for his grandmother. She will teach him his first great lesson. So First Man traveled the world, looking at everything. He saw rainbows and birds and flowers. He saw everything that was beautiful. He loved this world he was in. Then he came to a river. And he saw across the river a house. He knew it was his grandmother's house. Now, he had never seen a river before, so he tried to walk across the water and splash. He fell into the water. He crawled out, coughing and sputtering, and wondered, how do I get across this river? I know, I'll put dirt upon the water. He put dirt upon the water, tried to walk across, splash. He fell in again. He stood on the shore. I will put rocks upon the water. And he put rocks upon the water, tried to walk across, splash. He fell in again. He wondered what to do, and then he saw a log floating down the river, and on the log were little birds. And he said, I will do like the birds. I will make a raft and go across the river. So he took one log, tried to float across, but it was too little. He was too heavy. Splash, he fell in again. I will use two logs, he said. Again, they were too little. He was too big. Splash, he fell in again. I will use four logs. He got four logs. Now they could hold his weight, but they kept drifting apart, and splash, he fell in again. A little bush was sitting nearby and said, use my vines for a rope and tie them together. So First Man took the vines from the bush and tied the logs together. Now he created a raft. And he got a pole, and he poled his way across the river. And he walked into his grandmother's house. She was waiting for him. He said, Grandmother, I'm so happy to see you. I've been looking for you. And she said, Grandson, I've been waiting for you. I am so happy to see you. He said, Grandmother, you're supposed to teach me my first great lesson. She said, you have already learned your first great lesson. And he said, what do you mean? What have I learned? She said, when you heard I lived, your grandmother, you loved me and you wanted to find me. Your heart told you to find me. But then you came to the river, and you could not figure out how to get across the river. Your brain helped you figure out how to get across the river. This is the order of the world. Your heart tells you the good things you want to do, and your brain helps you figure out how to do them. When you want to know what to do, follow your heart. When you want to know how to do it, follow your brain. Do not confuse this process. This is the first great lesson that Grandmother gave to First Man. It is the first great lesson she gave to us all.
That is lovely.
I love that story. We indoctrinate second graders with that story. So.
So when did you first hear that story?
Maybe seven, eight years ago. I've been doing a curriculum with some of the schools that's based on something called StoryPath, which is a national curriculum that focuses on the Wampanoag people. Now, being a local tribal person, I'm like, you could be teaching about the local tribes here.
Sure.
But looking at the curriculum and understanding that most American children are going to hear that Thanksgiving story without hearing about the Wampanoag people, I thought it fulfills a very important function. And then the ending of it, Your heart tells you the good things you want to do. Your brain helps you figure out how to do it. To me, that is a universal native philosophy of life.
So are all stories, in a way, origin stories? I mean, isn't every story about the origin of something? Of, if it's two people that fall in love, it's the origin of their love. In a way, are all stories origin stories, the start of something?
Good question. I think that something changes, something happens. Something has to change. I tell people, when, if I just said there was a stone wall fence and a tree, that's a report, right? I just told you it's there. But if I said in a storm the tree fell on the stone wall fence and smashed it, then that's a story, because something has happened. Something has changed. Picasso once said that art is the lie by which we see the truth. And I think a story is akin to that, in that it creates in our being a condition that wasn't there before, and it allows us to build upon that, create from that, to understand through that. So I guess in the biggest sense, I appreciate you putting it that way. They are origin stories. Something has changed, and something now is going to happen after that. Something new is going to happen after that, because something has changed.
Roger Fernandez is an artist and an educator and a storyteller. He spoke with Sound Effects senior producer Arwin Nix. It's Sound Effect from KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. We're talking origin stories this week, and here is Bill Puckett's voicemail.
Please leave your name, your phone number, and the best time to call if you're reporting a UFO sighting. Leave name, phone number, the date of your sighting, the time of your sighting, the city, state, and country of your sighting, and a brief description, and your call will be returned.
Okay, this is a public service of sorts. Puckett will record your UFO sightings and investigate them. He's a longtime Washington resident, and he lives in Helena, Montana now. And that's where he runs this group called UFOs Northwest. So thinking about how Bill's interest in UFOs began, he says he remembers hearing about flying saucers during the early wave of sightings.
You know, they were scary. I mean, it created a national panic. I mean, it was in the national press, and it scared me. Of course, later on, I kind of piqued my curiosity, but in the 1950s, it was a pretty scary phenomenon.
So like a lot of things in childhood, first it scared you, and then it sort of intrigued you?
Right, absolutely.
And part of what captivated Bill Puckett was hearing about this one specific incident that took place in Washington, over the Cascade Mountains, an episode that formed the origin story for the entire UFO phenomenon.
Oh, I knew about the Kenneth Arnold incident when I grew up back here in Montana in the 1950s. I mean, UFO sightings were in the national news in those days, and it was well known that that's when it started, and it was June 24th, 1947.
Would you sort of walk me through the Kenneth Arnold incident?
Well, on June 24th, 1947, Kenneth Arnold got in a light aircraft in Chehalis, Washington, and he was going to fly to Yakima, and he was a search and rescue pilot, and there was a lost plane over Mount Rainier. He thought he would divert a little bit to check out if he could see if he could find this plane. And while he was doing that, these nine silvery objects, sort of shaped kind of like boomerangs, he saw flying out ahead of him. He clocked them between Mount Rainier and Mount Adams. And I believe that he estimated their speed at upwards of 1,800 miles an hour. Of course, at that time, we had jet aircraft, a few, but none of them would fly that fast. That's when the UFO, modern wave of ufology got started, because the press got note of it, and the actual term flying saucer was coined by one of the press officers.
Can you spell out how the term flying saucer came about?
I think Kenneth Arnold, you know, used the analogy, they look like saucers skipping on water.
So that term flying saucer has really taken hold in the popular imagination. And now when we think about a UFO or an alien craft, it's almost always saucer shaped. But what Arnold described wasn't saucer shaped, right?
Not exactly. They were more boomerang shaped. However, subsequent to that, you know, there's been a lot of flying saucer sightings.
How would you describe the reaction and the kind of publicity that followed Arnold's story?
Well, it generated a lot of publicity, and, you know, there was a newscast.
We are honored indeed to have here in our studio this man, Kenneth Arnold, who we believe may be able to give us a first-hand account and give you the same on what happened.
They looked something like a pie plate that was cut in half with a sort of a convex triangle in the rear. Now, I thought, well, that maybe they're jet planes with just the tails painted green or brown or something, and didn't think too much of it, but kept on watching them.
It generated a lot of newspaper articles, and then it also seemed to get the military's attention, because it wasn't too long after that they started Project Sign, and of course, the famous Roswell incident happened only a couple weeks after the Kenneth Arnold sighting. I think something really happened, because there were just hundreds and hundreds of sightings that summer of 1947. They started in June. They peaked in around the 7th of July, around the time the Roswell crash. And then they tapered down to real low numbers later in August. It wasn't just all press bias.
For people who are into ufology and studying this stuff, what is the significance of the Kenneth Arnold story?
Well, I would call it perhaps a Rosetta Stone of UFO sightings. Some people would say that'd be Roswell, but I would say that the flying discs are still seen. I mean, I've had reports here just this past week. I'm trying to acquire photos from this woman that saw a flying disc in eastern, or I should say western Kansas, and saw a being inside of it. The disc was quite close to her. The significance of that is that they were unexplained in 1947. They're still unexplained in 2015.
Do you think that Kenneth Arnold, was he a believer?
Yeah, he wrote a book. I'm looking at it right now, The Coming of the Saucers. So yeah, he was a believer. However, later in his life, he wished he had never even got into it, because it just involved a lot of harassment. And I don't know whether it affected his run for lieutenant governor of Idaho or not, but he kind of regretted later in life of being involved with it.
Is that a feeling that you understand? That feeling of, gosh, I wish I had just kept my mouth shut?
Absolutely. I mean, even myself as a UFO investigator, I've been targeted by neighbors and stuff as kind of a crackpot. You know, what's this guy doing investigating UFOs? If you're not amiable to public criticism, it's best to be more discreet about your beliefs. However, skeptics do have some ammunition. I mean, there is a lot of deception in the UFO field, this chemtrail nonsense and Planet X and 2012, even though that's not totally UFO, it's UFO related. And, you know, you start talking that kind of junk around scientists and they're going to say, you know, what planet do you reside? I mean, it's, you know, it's not reliable information. And I try to stick with forensics and photos and videos and radar data, but I still can't prove scientifically that UFOs are non-terrestrial or higher dimensional or, you know, due to other paranormal phenomena. I believe it, but I can't prove it.
Is it ever lonely to believe something that mainstream science and culture dismiss?
Somewhat. You know, it would be nice to have the support of the scientific community, politicians. It's a bit frustrating, but, you know, it's just, it goes with the territory.
Well, William Puckett helps to run UFOs Northwest, and we'll link to his site on our webpage, kplusoundeffect.org. Bill, thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you very much for inviting me.
It's Sound Effect from KPLU. Up next, we're going to get into an origin story of a hometown delicacy, a weird one. So when you think of iconic Seattle foods, you might think of salmon or Dick's Burgers or a styrofoam thingy of teriyaki, but the city has another culinary tradition that tends to fly under the radar, the Seattle-style hot dog. It's a perplexing thing, to me at least, and we wanted to know where it came from. So KPLU's Matthew Strybe went out in search of its origin.
I am getting fat, and if I have anything to blame for it, it's the Seattle dog. I eat two or three a week. Now, for those of you who are unfamiliar, a Seattle dog could be any kind of hot dog, but it's distinguished by a heap of grilled onions and a smear of melting cream cheese. Seattle dogs are very popular late at night when intoxicated diners hit up street vendors. I went out to Capitol Hill at 2 a.m., where patrons told me cream cheese makes hot dogs unforgettable.
It just gives it just a little extra that is something you can't get anywhere else.
First one's kind of weird, second one's like pretty decent. Third one, you're just like, I'm addicted.
Cream cheese, like, inserted into the hot
dog. Yeah, no,
like,
I don't think it sounds kind of gross, but it's really not gross.
Especially when you get the hot links with the cream cheese.
Yeah, mix it all together.
Perfect.
Perfect.
But why is a hot dog covered in cream cheese called a Seattle dog? Where would this even come from?
It's a new phenomenon. It became the Seattle-style hot dog when some Moroccan dude started selling them on the hill.
Trailer somewhere in Spokane.
Someone from Philadelphia? I don't know. Probably.
Now, I'm from Pennsylvania, and I can tell you this. No one in Philadelphia puts cream cheese on a hot dog. This is a Seattle thing. And from the get-go, I was pretty sure the late-night diners on Capitol Hill were all wrong about where it came from. So I decided to try and find the origin, and I asked vendors where I should go. They sent me down to Safeco Field to see Al Griffin of Al's Gourmet Sausage. Al's been selling hot dogs for 21 years. He was the first to sell them at the stadium, covertly tucking his stand inside someone's garage before the city allowed street vending in 2002.
Had a guy come out 2:30 in the morning, get his sausage, and kid you not, he went into his pocket and pulled out a packet of cream cheese. And I said, wow, this cream cheese is pretty serious, man. And ever since then, I made sure I kept it at the stand.
So Al didn't invent the idea, but he was the one who put grilled onions on it. So who put the cream cheese on it?
If I had to give the credit, because I was back there then, yeah, I think the guy that used to sell the bagels pretty much was doing the bagel thing at night, and I think it kind of caught from there.
A bagel guy? Cream cheese and bagels make sense, but who eats a hot dog on a bagel? I mean, a hot dog is long and a bagel is round. It doesn't work. And who is this bagel guy? All clues pointed to a man named Hadley Long, so I headed out to Coeur d'Alene, Idaho to meet him. I pulled up to a little yellow house on a corner, the home of the bagel guy. He expected me and had pulled out memorabilia from decades ago in Pioneer Square. Strewn across his yard and in his house, there was everything. There were banners, there were t-shirts that said Hadley the Bagel Man, and there were hundreds of Polaroids of Hadley with smiling people holding pork products. He was a different Hadley then, with sideburns, bushy hair, and smizing Windex blue eyes as he mans his wooden cart. He still has that cart, and was excited to stand behind it again.
Pretend I'm buying a spicy with hot dog with cream cheese.
Number one seller.
You're handing it to me. What do you say to me?
I say to you, hold on to it. Two hands.
Why do I need to hold on to it?
Because it's going to just fly right out of there. It's going to jump out of there. That cream cheese is slippery.
Being a bagel vendor in Seattle was a lifelong dream for Hadley. He grew up in Athens, Ohio, where as a teenager in the 70s, he would frequent the cart of Louie the Bagel Man. Bagels back then were hip, popular, and Louie was always the center of attention.
So I saw him doing it, and I said, well, I want to be the bagel man, but I'll go to another college town. They were so unique, you know, and I wouldn't necessarily say cutting edge, but, you know, they were new.
I know it may sound weird to hear bagels called cutting edge, but until recently, they kind of were. Bagels have been a Jewish staple for centuries, but in the 1960s, Americans were so unfamiliar with them that the New York Times had to explain what they were. They called a bagel, quote, an unsweetened donut with rigor mortis. It was only in the 1970s that bagels started to be sold across the country. So in Ohio, they were new. And it was in the late 1980s that bagels began to be so popular that they would eclipse donut sales. And this peak of popularity was when Hadley moved to Seattle to open up his very own bagel shop. I know, you thought this was a story about a hot dog, and it is. Hadley was a vegetarian, and so were all of his products. But Hadley's customers wanted meat. And so in 1988, he put a hot dog on a bagel.
I did not want to be a hot dog vendor for business. It was just something I had to do. So my compromise was, well, I'll just put it on my bagel stick instead of the round bagel, the Bialy stick, and then I'd put cream cheese on there. So I wouldn't be selling, you know, in my mind, I wouldn't be selling out, you know.
But this wasn't the Seattle dog that we know today. When Hadley described his Seattle dog, he talked about it being a hearty meal with poppy seeds and dehydrated onions that gave it subtle complexity. He was proud of it, and it was popular. Hadley told me the grunge scene was instrumental in its growth. His cart was right next to the clubs where bands like Pearl Jam, Soundgarden, and Alice in Chains got their start, and concertgoers would come to see Hadley after their shows. Then, other vendors started copying him, and the Seattle dog, as we know it today, was born.
I had one-on-one relationship with, like, every customer. You know, it wasn't just a transaction, you know. It wasn't just a sale. I got to be friends with all these people. I actually had good camaraderie and loved ones. And I was the only one out there, which is another reason I left, you know. I saw me being copied all over town and such.
A lot of the people who have copied you have signs that say, like, they're the home of the Seattle dog or the original Seattle dog. How does it feel when you hear or see of other people claiming credit for it?
Well, more power to them, but, you know, they know they're false, you know. I don't want to say they're liars, but let's just say, you know, it's just they know they're not true. Let's put it that way. There was only one, and I was the original.
Hadley Long left Seattle in 2004, but his legacy remains, if only on my waistline.
Whether or not you are remembered for it, you are, I guess, a part of Seattle now, because the Seattle dog has become a thing. It is a thing.
Foodie history, as one of my friends said. Had, you are Seattle foodie history.
That story from KPLU's Matthew Stribe. We've kind of left this unsaid so far, but the whole idea of an origin story comes from comic books. It's the whole backstory of how a character got his or her powers or became, you know, the character that we've come to know. And in the case of Ammon Walker, there's really two origin stories, and they're both kind of amazing. One is how he became a superhero, and then the other one is how Aaron DiRico came to invent him. DiRico lives in Friday Harbor, and as he was growing up, he always wanted to be a soccer star. But there was a problem with that. He has cerebral palsy. So he figured out a way to live that dream in the pages of a comic book instead of on the soccer pitch. And when he came in and sat down with us, he talked about how his soccer dreams came from his father.
My dad was a first-round draft pick for the original Seattle Sounders in 1974 and a captain of the national team. And I wanted to follow in his footsteps, but couldn't. And then in 98, I learned that Sean Connery was almost a soccer star. And then I thought to myself, what if the world's most famous fictional spy was a soccer star? And then I was like, well, what if that was his cover? And then I was like, ooh, what if I give him superpowers? And I thought, ooh, I'll add a personal element. I'll give him part of my story. He has a disability, cerebral palsy, and he dreams of being a soccer gladiator like his father. But because the cerebral palsy affects his legs, he can't. And then he works for years and years to find a cure, has many setbacks. Finally, he's able to invent a technology that heals him, and then he's sabotaged. And in the course of overcoming that sabotage, he discovers a spiritual power source that gives him the shamanic power of the dragonfly.
So let's talk about CP for a second.
Yes.
What is cerebral palsy, and how does it affect you?
Well, cerebral palsy is a nerve condition where my brain is getting electrical signals where parts of my muscles are too tight, like a fist, and other parts are too relaxed. It keeps me from, you know, doing things like running and dancing, and even standing in place sometimes is challenging because it's like, again, imagine making a fist and it's just, it cuts off the circulation. It does get frustrating, but thankfully mine is what's called a mild version. There's lesser versions where it only affects like the hand, and then there's mild, and then there's severe. For instance, the movie My Left Foot, where people can barely blink.
I know you're, particularly in your adult life, you're really focused on resilience and helping people overcome and bounce back. But there must underneath that also be some really difficult times, I have a feeling. What was it like, particularly growing up, idolizing your dad, who is a soccer star, an athlete, you know, a really elite athlete, yeah, and it's just out of your reach?
It was challenging, especially when I was a kid and I had an awareness of what my dad had done. And I don't blame them, but kids didn't know that. And I would say, I want to play soccer. And they would say, we don't want you on the team. And it was hard, you know? And so I, instead of letting that define me, I created him, you know?
What role has creating Ammon Walker played in your sort of learning how to cope with all that?
It gives me hope, and it gives me, because I want to give other people hope. I want to give people a character they can admire and look up to, because I know for me, reading things like Doctor Strange, about a doctor who loses his ability to use his hands and heals himself, and Daredevil overcoming blindness, that gave me hope, even though it wasn't specific to what I had. And I thought, why don't I get really specific, and maybe this can inspire people of all ability levels who have such a desire to live, and maybe Ammon can give them a voice that they haven't had before, you know, of what it's like.
Yeah. So, yeah, thinking about Ammon and his, the way that he comes to overcome his disability, I mean, there's like a long history in comics of people without power who create very powerful fantasy kind of alter egos. Like the creators of Superman were these relatively marginalized sons of Jewish immigrants who create this great iconic hero or whatever. Do you see yourself as fitting into that or reacting against that, or how?
I love Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. They were turned down so many times by every publisher, and they kept with it. They had a vision, and they, to me, they're the Elvis of superheroes. They made it all possible, you know, and I feel that Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, that duo, was sort of the Beatles or Jimi Hendrix, if you will. They took it even further, made it more personal, and added, you know, humanity and flaws to the heroes. But they gave voice to the shunned, to the nerds, to the shy, and so I want to honor them. I want to honor everybody that's come before me. I really do.
How did you get the attention of Stan Lee, who's the creator of Spider-Man and Thor and all these iconic Marvel heroes?
In 2008, he was doing an online writing workshop, and I signed up. And he answered a lot of questions that helped me progress. And then right after that, I had the courage to submit my work to Eisner Award-winning comic book writer and artist Paul Chadwick, who became my mentor, such a great man. And in 2010, my mother, she was able to get enough money together to get me a ticket to go to the Emerald City Comic Con, and Paul was gracious enough to offer to drive me there. All I wanted to do was to thank Stan. I didn't want to, you know, geek out and go total fanboy. Impossible, but so we get there, and Paul was very nice. He said, so where do we get the tickets? And basically, they were pre-sold. I didn't know that, so we were turned away, and then literally my heart went from feeling kind of heavy and sad to I look up, and I am in awe, who's barreling down the hall surrounded by staff members but Stan the Man Lee. And then, even though there was a crowd of people, Stan and his assistant cut through the crowd, and he saw me, and he put his arm around me, and he said, how about a picture? And I was still trying to summon any kind of words. And he's about to leave, and then in front of everybody, I said, Stan, wait, thank you so much. I applied your wisdom, from your writing workshop, and because of that, now I have a mentor. Thank you so much. And then...
Take your time, Aaron.
Sorry. In front of my mentor, Paul, and the entire crowd, he shook my hand and said, I'll be looking for your work, and I expect great things from you. He doesn't know that my friends used to compare me and tell me I look like Peter Parker, and that helped me go from C's and D's to almost all A's. He doesn't know how much reading his comics liberated me from limitation. He doesn't know what an amazing impact he's had on my life. And so for such an amazing man to give me that encouragement, it empowered me, and it's helped me get through so much.
It's so powerful what you said about reading Spider-Man. The whole idea of these comic heroes is the powerlessness transformed into power.
Yes.
And exactly. that's what Ammon is.
Yes. I wanted to take the idea of with great power comes great responsibility, and have Ammon embody that from the start of his life.
Yeah.
When I was 5 years old, my mother was carrying me up the stairs, and I told her, I said, Mommy, I know why I have cerebral palsy. And she smiled. She said, why is that? I said, so I can heal myself and teach others how to heal. So that's been my mission since I was five. And so I had Ammon becomes a doctor specifically to do that. And I want to use Ammon's adventures to show an idea that I came up with for a technology that could hopefully heal people. And I want to take that from comic books to animated motion comics to movies, and definitely into a video game that designed to make rehabilitation fun. And people play as Ammon. They learn to walk, then run, then play soccer. And they learn to develop their strength of character in the process, so that by the time they become able to walk and run and kick and so on, they have the strength of character to use their new abilities wisely.
Well, Aaron DiRico is an artist and a writer who lives at Friday Harbor, and he's developing the debut issue of Ammon Walker. He's got a crowdfunding campaign underway right now. We're going to link to information about it from our website, kplusoundeffect.org. And Aaron, thank you so much for being on the show.
Gabriel, thank you.
Sound Effect comes to you from senior producer Arwin Nix and producer Kevin Kniestead. We had help from producer Matthew Strive and intern Bree Ripley. Thanks also to Paula Whistle and to web-slinger Mike Lewis. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. You can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. You can write us a quick review while you're there. And also, you can send your feedback to soundeffect@kplu.org or tweet at KPLU. And be here next week at the same bat time when our theme is Someone Saved My Life.
I'm the one who should jump off the boat. And another character who was a world-famous rock star with no dependence and a drug problem said, no, it should be me because I really have done everything I want to do. And then the young girl, she was probably 14, who played the homeless woman said, no, you don't understand. This is the most important thing I'm going to ever get to do, and you need to let me do it.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KPLU.